Hey everybody, welcome back to Too Much Future. This is episode 18.
Mm-hmm.
I just looked this up and I had to look at it again. Episode 18, this is a show about Fallout, where we talk about the Fallout games. We're currently playing Fallout 2. I'm Cameron.
I'm Michael.
And this is the end of the game.
It is the end of Fallout 2.
Is that you've been working on that all day?
Yep. I've been working on that since 8 o'clock this morning. The end of Fallout 2 jingle.
You got your ocarina out,
yeah.
Like to make sure it worked down the scale appropriately.
Yeah.
I don't know how you play an ocarina. Actually, don't know anything about music.
Can't even hear it.
You can buy my music album I made several years ago, though, if you really want to. So, you know, don't let knowing nothing stop you.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to art, that's my big advice. This is actually a stealth pilot for my other show, My Big Advice. Next week, it's going to be My Big Advice about construction. Michael, we got to the end of the game.
We did.
Last episode, we took a tanker. We smashed that tanker / docked that tanker into the Enclave base, which is an oil derrick.
Mm-hmm.
Oil rig. Are those different?
I think they are, but I don't know. Who cares?
Well, so that's actually episode 3, which is My Big Advice about oil terminology. And so we did that, and this is the end of the thing. It's actually pretty short as far as things are concerned, but I get the sense that there's probably a few different ways things could go, and I imagine, though I'm not certain, I imagine that we probably had different experiences of this. So you have docked. You go inside the Enclave base. What's Twelinor doing, Michael?
Well, the first couple of things that happen here is I realize that you cannot have a party in this final level, because if you do, you are automatically seen as hostile by everyone, and it just becomes a total shootout. Yes, right? If you have... I know that different parts of the game people will I've talked about this, right? Different parts of the game NPCs will respond differently to different sorts of followers, so I don't know if maybe some followers can be brought through here no problem, or if there's like a if you have like a low number of followers or something. But mm-hmm. I had just to recap, I have with me Myron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Real special treat of information at the end of the game. Yes. About Myron too, that we'll come back. Yes. To but
so I have Myron, I have Marcus, I used to have Lenny. At one point Lenny died and I didn't mark it on the show because I don't think I realized, but Lenny's gone. Lenny was that RIP. Ghoul who really wanted
I was wondering about that, because his being stuck outside didn't really come up too often recently.
Yeah, no. So Lenny really wanted to hang out with the Vault Dweller back in Fallout 1, and then I said, hey, why don't you come with me? I'm having an adventure, and then he died. So mm-hmm. Just goes to show you, never go on adventures. But I also have with me Goris, the Talking Deathclaw, and K-9, the RoboCop dog. All of these people are just being murdered all the time. I'm being murdered all the time. Or not really being murdered, but like, because I, you know, became Helenor in the last episode. But it's just, mm-hmm. I keep walking in and everyone's auto-hostiling me. And it's like, there's got to be a better way to do this. Turns out, I just leave all of my party members in like, the foyer of this map. Mm-hmm. And make my way into the Enclave base. And, it looks pretty cool. Do you agree?
I do agree. It's this is probably the most realized like location in Mages and Murder Dads, you know, the other Range Touch show where we talked about the Baldur's Gate games. We used a term that's come up a few times in this show too, Gygaxian,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is the idea, kind of the design ethic of Gary Gygax, which is each little, like, each dungeon creates an ecology that all interrelates to one another. So the famous example, the beginning of Baldur's Gate 2, is that there's an Ot-Yug, which eats trash in the middle of the dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there because you gotta get rid of your trash somehow. And so you gotta put an Ot-Yug in it. This is, other than some of the vaults, this is the most Gygaxian designed location, in that there are bedrooms, there's a gym, mm-hmm. there are break rooms, there are bathrooms, there's shower stalls, there's like all the different things that you would think of that would really be in, you know, a big kind of community oriented bunker. And it's all there. And I actually find that really cool, although that does mean that this is probably one of the most visually dense areas in this game or the last game, while being one of the least content dense, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. It is.
Because there's not a lot of people to talk to.
Yeah, no, it is striking. Like, in other points in this game, or these games really, when we've encountered areas that I felt were particularly Gygaxian, I felt that they were kind of, lacking, right? They didn't really have a lot to them in terms of game content. But here you can see, like, I enjoyed the end of this game. I'll come out at the top here and say this. Like, Fallout 2, the ending of this game actually really works in a lot of ways. And one of the ways that you can see it working is that it takes this Gygaxian philosophy of like dungeon design, and it does just what you said. It makes it visually dense, so you get a lot of almost like painterly storytelling in the mm-hmm. map, right? You get a sense for this place, who lives here, what this what the Enclave sort of priorities are, so on and so forth. You get so much out of this area just by being able to see it, that mm-hmm. it felt like a really good realization of that philosophy. Whereas in other parts, I remember like the first kind of the Vault 15 in the first game, you go there and it's just an abandoned vault, just empty. And there's nothing else to learn about it other than what you see when you first look at it, which is that it's an abandoned vault. And here, Twelinor, you know, goes into these massive rooms with all of these people, all of these NPCs. And in previously, I've talked about how when they flood the screen with NPCs, especially in Fallout 2, it's super frustrating because you are looking for someone who's going to move the plot along, and none of the NPCs are visually distinct. You have to mouse over each one and find the person who has a slightly different descriptor. Mm-hmm. That's still true here. But at the same time, it felt like the NPCs that I was looking out for, it was clear where they were on the map, because the map had been designed in such a way that I was like, oh, this guy's kind of off by himself, or this guy is behind a desk with a giant United States seal behind it.
I eventually got to that point, but I spent a lot of time on that first map, in which there's no one to talk to, as far as I could tell. There's no one on, like, level one that is worth talking to. I spent a lot of time clicking my way around that thing before I got to those, you know, kind of better earmarked people. So I don't know if I adapted as well.
I mean, maybe it was just luck for me, right? But, well, did you... So who was the first person you talked to? Did you talk to the Elder?
Yeah, that okay. would be... And that's on the second level.
Yes. Okay, yeah. So the... Like, you go into the Enclave, it's this pre-war oil rig, very Art Nouveau. It's the most technologically advanced place we've seen in these games thus far, even more so than the Brotherhood of Steel, which always kind of had, they were always very advanced, but they always had a kind of almost goofy retro future look to a lot of their technology. The Enclave is... more, it's darker, it's much more like Art Deco, much more imposing in that way. And eventually you go through this lab with all the, there's people in vault suits, there's people in lab suits, of course there's people in Enclave power armor, and eventually you find the holding cells, where a bunch of other people in vault suits, plus all of the Arroyo villagers are being held captive. And you can talk to the Elder. The Elder's back. And you learn a couple of things. One was that the people of Arroyo, at first, when the vertebrates landed and the Enclave was herding everyone in, they thought that they were going to heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were like, heck yeah, here we go. Because, and the reason they thought that is because there were also Vault 13 people on it.
Right, so there are Vault 13 people who come off, they see the Vault 13 jumpsuits, and Arroyo understands this as like, salvation. But it turns out that's not what the Enclave is here for. We still don't know what the Enclave is up to precisely, but everyone gets onto the... Everyone is kidnapped, and we have this interesting split that's apparently happened between the Vault 13 people who were helping the Enclave round up the Arroyo villagers, but then also we have other Vault 13 people also in their holding cells. So this is another thing that happens in this area that is interesting, where you get kind of story details or plot developments that are not delivered to you at the level of exposition, right? We just look at this and we know that there has been some sort of weird division among the Vault Dwellers. So, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting. Anyhow, the Elder told me, well, we gotta get out of here. we have to... She tells you to, like, cut the power, but she puts it in something like the machine that feeds this... that feeds the energy to the cells or something, because they have those holographic cell doors. Is down below, take out the power, and also, hey, just in case you haven't found one yet, you could probably find a Gek here.
Yeah, there was that. And also we get an additional, like, elaboration of, like, experimentation, right? Did you have the dialogue option?
That's right, yes. Oh, that's... So the Enclave is doing experiments. Yeah, tell us about those.
She just says, it's really funny, and, like, I get why this is happening, right? But the, all the stuff we've already talked about Arroyo, right? This kind of like, hierarchy of humanity, all the stuff we talked about in the first and second episodes of Fallout 2, all of that's here. But so you have to, you have the Elder who was both saying things like, we thought we were going to heaven. These flying birds came out of the sky. And then also saying things like, they inject us with things that look like stim packs.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so there's this kind of thing of like, of knowing what stim packs are and having a good sense of what stim packs are, but not like a flying machine in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
When you know they trade with other people, there are some places where the way that Fallout 2 is written are kind of smashing into one another here that are interesting. I think that if you were going to write about the kind of evocation of primitivism or like the tensions that are inherent in Fallout 2, I think this is the speech that you would like want to start with.
Mm-hmm.
But all to say, so she says they're injecting us with stim packs, and what they do is they like make like boils and things like that erode, you know, erupt all over our body, and then we like kind of explode. Mm-hmm. for lack of a better word. She calls it FEV.
Yes,
but like FEEVEE. FEV.
Right, which, of course, as the player, we know that FEV is, like, the letters FEV, Forced Evolutionary Virus, but the Elder sees it as FEV, right, like one word, almost like a, you know, incantation thing. And again, it's that exact same tension that you're gesturing toward, where on the one hand, these people are quote unquote primitives and they misunderstand the things that they see. And then on the other hand, they have sometimes just conveniently well-developed like scientific and technological vocabularies that are completely of a piece with the rest of the world.
Yeah, they are quote unquote modern when it's convenient, and they are quote unquote primitive when it's convenient. Mm-hmm. And there's something, I wonder how they got here, you know, and how that worked, but in any case, that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, so she says, you have to like destroy, cause they're behind force fields. And she's like, you gotta get us out. And when that happens, we'll just run away. Like, you don't have to come back and get us, is basically what the game is saying.
Yes.
You don't have to worry about us. You can just like, destroy the power here and then run the hell out, and then we'll be on the boat.
Mm-hmm. So that's sort of like your first goal, and really your only goal here is to get to the generator of this base and take it out.
Mm-hmm. And that was my only goal.
Yep. So I guess broad, like from a broad view, what happens for Tongston next? Like, does this go pretty smoothly? Are there, like, detours? Or how does it work?
This is extremely... Oh, well, this is also Tonk Regained.
Tonk Regained.
But, you know, much like Proust. Yeah, basically, I mean, I'm running around in Enclave power armor.
Mm-hmm.
So no one's mad or anything like that. And I'm zipping around. And basically, it was mostly about getting to the place where I could do that. Now, I talked to several other characters between here and the power generator, which is at the very bottom. I think it's level 4 of the base, or level 5.
Mm-hmm.
At the bottom, wherever that is. And it must be level 5. And I talked to several people along the way that implied that there would be several other things that I could do here. But...
Interesting.
Tonk is not smart.
Oh.
You know, in the quote-unquote smart, in the sense of the game does not give him additional dialogue options. So it was mostly just talking to people and getting a big lore dump, many of which were pretty cool, and then going and doing the thing and then running away. I mean, that's basically my whole thing here. So did you have anything interesting happen between here and blowing up the generator?
Well, so... Based on what you've just said, I am not entirely sure if we had very different play experiences, because it could have described what happened with Helinor as well, which was, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking as I was playing this is like, oh, this kind of becomes a walking sim, right? Mm-hmm. To just be egregiously anachronistic. There was very little for most of this map that I was doing that was not just walking around, looking at people, and then finding someone who could have a conversation with me, exhausting my dialogue options, and then moving on. There might have been differences in how much information we got respectively, but then also, I don't really know, because it seems like, more so than the first game, this one has been willing to give characters with low intelligence scores actual dialogue or, like, exposition. So, I don't know. I guess we'll figure this out.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about that, right, is that this feels very much like, you know, the word linear gets evoked in a lot of ways, in like negative ways. And I don't mean to say linear in a negative way, right? Because I think the dichotomy we put between linearity and choice and all that kind of stuff, I think that's like overly simplistic. It's probably not good for actually talking about games, but it is linear in the sense of there are a finite number of people to talk to. And more importantly, as long as you kind of play by the rules, it's actually pretty bizarre. They know that you are a, you know, quote unquote tribal. They know who you are. I mean, they comment on me specifically repeatedly about, you know, not the chosen one thing, but that I obviously am not an Enclave soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But they just kind of play out their dialogue anyway. Like, they don't really care about that. They don't seem worried about it. So it's this weird kind of thing where basically anywhere else in the game, and in Fallout 1, too, you would think that the moment I talked to them, they would be like, you don't belong here, and then combat would happen.
Mm-hmm.
But what ends up happening is it starts feeling kind of like a like an adventure game or kind of like later RPGs.
Yes.
Where it puts the responsibility on you to, if you would like to have combat here or if you would like to solve this through combat, that is a choice that is available to you, but if you don't take that option, the game will not force it on you. And that's very out of step with the rest of this game. And it's a good, and to be clear, I think that's a good move too. I agree with you. I think the end of this game is pretty interesting, and it's largely because it's not shunting me off into these, you know, if I talk to someone and if I'm not the right kind of polite, they're just going to beat me up. That doesn't happen here. And that's, you know, a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think the first NPC that I had, that I encountered who had real dialogue options was Dr. Curling. Did you talk with him?
Yep, I did. Yeah. I think I talked to everyone you could talk to.
Okay. Yeah, so Dr. Curling is interesting. He's just he's like a lone scientist, like standing in his bedroom in the back corner of one of the maps. To give you an idea, we've already kind of talked about this, I think, obliquely. The way that this map is set up is that you just go through, like these rooms connect to each other, or the maps connect to each other, you go through each one, and it funnels you into the place where you are eventually going to take out the generator. So it is really just walking around and looking for the people to talk to that you can talk to, or looking for the next door that you need to go through. So you find Dr. Curling, he's up in his bedroom, off in the corner of one of these maps. And he talks about how busy he is and all the work that he is doing. He says, he's much too busy to talk, with a mutant, is how he phrases it.
Mm-hmm.
And what your responses to this, are variations along, well, in true Fallout fashion, right? The bottom option is always something like, who are you calling a mutant? Draws gun and shoots you in the head or something like that. But the other options are things like, wait a minute, I'm not a mutant. Or, you know, just sort of generally, what are you talking about? And in talking with Curling, you learn some very, very interesting stuff, which is that the Enclave is planning on, as he puts it, reestablishing the United States. God bless America, he finishes this up with, and goes into kind of his plan, or the plan of the Enclave, which is that FEV, the Forced Evolutionary Virus, was rediscovered, and the Enclave has been doing experiments with it. One of the things they found out you can do, and this is the thing Curling himself has done quite specifically, he's modified it to be a, instead of like a virus that makes you evolve or whatever, he has made it a virus that just straight up kills you. And the Enclave very much would like to disperse this this biological weapon onto the mainland, because they have discovered, quote unquote, that the DNA of people who have lived outside of the vaults, even if they are not ghouls or super mutants, has changed in some way enough that the Enclave now no longer considers those people human. So you, the player character, Tonk Regained or whatever, those people are no longer human in the eyes of the Enclave because their DNA is different somehow. So quite literally, like, what the Enclave wants to do is release this virus and just kill everyone. Like, all ghouls, all super mutants, all humans who live outside of vaults. That is what they want to do. What do you think of that?
Well, I guess two things. On one hand, it's interesting the way that, I don't know if he gives you the full story, but after you talk to a couple people, you get the full story that it's kind of only because the vault dweller blew up the master that they discovered FEV, because they discover it kind of digging down into that military base, which is, that's fun, you know, a fun connector. The other thing too is that everyone repeatedly keeps telling you that the way they're going to spread this, because you can say, or, you know, I could say, well, you know, wouldn't it kill the hosts too fast for them to do it? That might have been my science skill. And he was like, well, actually, we're just going to, it's an aerosol thing. We're going to shoot it into the jet stream.
Yes.
And the people say the jet stream several times. It's like a real moment of like, in a game that doesn't always explain everything, it's like, this is a moment where they were like, sure to give you the real science behind it, which is very funny to me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I there's a part of it where he says something like, you're no more human to me than a two-headed cow.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, like, woof. But yeah, so I mean, you know, the Enclave, it's unfortunate because this is like, you know, big villain stuff, right? Mm-hmm. This is their plot, this is their plan. They're not just abducting people. It's not just the Brotherhood of Steel's problem with them, which is like that it's a power differential. They're just like cosmic eugenicists. You know, they're bad. They're just like, you know, as bad as you can get. And you know, I like that. I just wish that, I mean, I don't like that, but I think that's a good plot motivation. I think that's a good bit of writing. It's unfortunate that you only find out about it in the last 30 minutes of the game.
Yeah.
I really wish that, you know, somewhere at the midpoint of the game that you, you know, you go down and you find Myron and you find out from Myron that Jet is something that was given to him by the Enclave in exchange for help determining something about the DNA of humans, right? Like, I don't know, but just anything else in this game. And maybe there is and we just missed it. You know, that is perfectly valid. Let us know about that if we just didn't see something here. But as far as I know, this is the first time that any of this has come up, and it's an interesting plot development that happens really late in the game.
Yeah, no, it is. So a lot, this will maybe be like a refrain for us in this episode, is that there's a lot of stuff that happens here at the end that in a I'll put it this way. In a more modern game, we would expect it to be seeded throughout the game, right? Like you just, that little example you just gave with Myron. And that's not how this is working out here. And I have, well, when we get to the end of the episode, I'll talk more about what I think is, like, how this works. But anyway, yeah, like, last episode I complained, like, why are we even going after the Enclave? Like, what are the Enclave doing? And it turns out, like, oh, this is bad. Like, this gives me some buy-in, and not only does it do that, it's fascinating to me because of how incoherent the Enclave is. And, like, I think we're supposed to understand that it is incoherent, because this FEV virus doesn't just kill people who have lived outside of vaults who have, like, the right amount of DNA that has changed, or it doesn't just kill ghouls and super mutants. It kills the Enclave, too. Did you get that part?
That FEV does?
Yes.
Well, currently it does, right? Because it's like not finished yet or something.
No, they have an antidote that you have to be inoculated with.
Okay. No, I didn't. I don't think I got any of that information.
Yeah. So one of the things I could do with Gerling. Well, I'll get. So here's what happened. Right. Gerling gives me this whole spiel about how the Enclave is purging all of the mutant elements out of the gene stock, and this includes just anyone who's lived outside of a vault. And then he says, and this is the specific phrasing he uses, he says, then the recolonization of the United States will begin. And then I could ask him, Twelinor could ask him, well, what if mutants were just another type of human? And he's like, oh, silly girl. You know, he like laughs it off. But you can keep pressing him on this, and this is some interesting writing. You just ask him questions. It's like, well, you know, what if mutants were just another type of human? And he's like, like you ask him various versions of this and push him along, and then he's like, I need to think on this. It's a tough pill to swallow. And then, you know, a couple of clicks later, he's like, you're right. And I have written this down. This is what he tells you. I was so blinded by trying to overcome the obstacles that I didn't think about the morality of my quest.
Just hanging some lampshades on that bad boy, huh?
Yeah, yeah. So Dr. Gerling, unfortunately, was experiencing flow and did not realize it was causing him to do genocide. And so after you've pointed this out to him...
I'm sorry, go ahead. You can finish your thing. No,
I'll say
my commentary for the end.
After you've pointed this out to him, he then explains that there is, like, this will kill everyone, right? Just anyone will die from this, unless they have been inoculated with the antidote. And then he quotes William Blake at you. He quotes the William Blake poem, The Tiger. You know, did he who make the lamb make thee? Yes. As he's like, so what he does as he's doing this is, he is releasing the FEV into the air vents of the Enclave, and he inoculates you, and he's like, you know, there are some people who have already been inoculated, but most of the people here, like, they haven't been inoculated yet. He lets the FEV out into the air vents, and, you get to watch everyone die. Like, they just all explode. Yeah, and that's how my interaction with Gerling ended, is that most of the NPCs died because he released the virus.
Wow.
Yeah, what's your commentary then?
this is just the ideology of all of these games, right? Like Planescape Torment, this game, Fallout 3, like all the Fallout games after this, right? Is like, you can smooth talk and logic your way out of any scenario.
Yeah.
And like if all you got to do is explain to the genocide guy that what he's doing is logically fallible and doesn't make any sense. And like, that'll work. It's interesting that, you know, these games get talked about as like, all your choices matter. You can use intelligence and skill. You're not just beating things up. All of those things, you can use the power of like mind stuff to solve problems. And admittedly, that's very cool. It's very good. I'm glad we have those games. But often that's a very particular kind of way of thinking is usable for that. Because like, for example, there's no emotional appeal that you could make. You couldn't be like, well, killing everyone on Earth is bad. Like, mm-hmm. That's wrong and bad and evil. You know, there's no morality score for you to make that argument. You can just, you know, logic your way through it. So,
right. And like the thing that struck me was I already told you, like, the Enclave's plan makes no sense, but it's impossible for me in dialogue to be like, wait a minute, like, why did you make this virus? Because the reason they need the FEV specifically, right, is that it does only work on, I guess, humans or things that used to be humans. The mm-hmm. FEV isn't going to affect trees or cows or something. I don't know. anyway, when they release the genocide chemical into the air, they don't want it to kill all biological life, just the human forms or the human-ish forms. So it seems very clear to me, right? Like, the distinction that the Enclave is trying to make between different types of people is just not something that holds up. Like, it is something, like, biologically, like, they've done some sort of research, and they've been like, yeah, people who live outside the vaults have DNA that is different in some way. But that doesn't mean that the FEV can specifically target them, right? It kills people outside the vaults no matter whether you're, you know, a tribal or if you're Enclave. So just fundamentally, right, this argument for what the human is that the Enclave is making does not make sense. And I wish you could point that out to the scientist, but apparently it's something that he not only overlooked in his quest to overcome the obstacle, it's something that doesn't occur to you as the player character.
Well, sometimes you're real smart, but not smart enough.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean you didn't talk to anybody else?
Yes, because it turns out all of the other important NPCs have been inoculated.
Oh, okay. Because I just assumed that maybe if you did that, then everyone died. But no. Okay, gotcha. So
no, so all of the people in vault suits died. All of the like scientists died. But people in power armor and certain government officials survive.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that means you talk to the president of the United States.
Yes, but first I talked to the vice president, of course.
Oh, you talked to him first? I went in, like, the back door, so I talked to the president first.
Okay.
Yeah, the VP just tells me about space.
Yeah, so the vice president of the United States is named Daniel Byrd. He is an extended parody of Dan Quayle.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which is... just mm-hmm. such a quaint thing to experience, really, in this day and age.
Yeah, if his lovable scampery.
Yeah, it's like, oh, for the viewer listener at home, prior to the presidency of George W. Bush, George W. Bush, famous for many things, one of them is that he said things wrong a lot. Supposedly, if you were alive during the 2000s, during the Bush presidency, in addition to all of the constant, you know, war and nightmare stuff that was happening then, you had like Bushisms, which were like supposedly like silly, nonsensical things that George W. Bush had actually said. But it turns out that many of these are recycled quotes that had been attributed back during the first Bush presidency to Vice President Dan Quayle. And so you get a lot of the, when you're talking with this vice president, he says things and they don't really make sense. There's a lot of non sequiturs, but you can always call him out for being a politician here. There's a point where you try to tell him, you know, like, you're just part of the problem. And he says, I'm not part of the problem. I'm a Republican. And you have one response, which is, like I said, part of the problem.
Ooh, zinger.
Right. So here we go. Here's where Fallout becomes satire. I would not say actually this is satire, right? This is more like humorous writing. Mm-hmm. But something that I said a couple of episodes ago where I said, I think one of the reasons Fallout can get misrecognized as satire is because it's willing to come closer to the social reality of the players than a lot of games are. Mm-hmm. And this is like a really great example of that, right? This game, which up until this point, to be clear, has honestly not been very political. Like, there hasn't been a lot of assignment of like particular political viewpoints to things, right? There have been things that are happening which you could deduce politics from.
Yeah.
Here, the game quite sort of explicitly puts a contemporary American political object, right, or series of objects in front of you, and invokes these known figures, and it, you know, it grows teeth to an extent, right? It's willing to say that Republicans are a part of the problem, which is very surprising, I guess, if it's 1999, and I mean, hell, that would be surprising today, honestly, if I played a game and the game were willing to just be like, you know what, Republicans suck.
I mean, that's a really good point. And maybe that is part of the kind of nostalgia for Fallout 2, is that the number of games that have done this exact maneuver are countable on one hand.
Yeah, right. Like, certainly we could find plenty of indie games, independently produced games that are very, very political. But you're not going to find something that is like a AAA release in quite the way Fallout 2 was in its own time that is going to not pull the punches here in terms of, like, political figures that it's ridiculing.
Yeah, just imagine it this way. In Fallout 4, there are no political, as far as I can remember, I played through the game, there are no real alignments to political parties. There are just, ironically enough, they are bad politicians, but there are no bad political parties. Literally, you know, precluding a structural critique of any kind. So, you know, it's a throwaway line on one hand. I think this is what you're pointing out. It's a throwaway line on one hand, but actually it's like pretty, you know, it's kind of a sledgehammer of a throwaway line to put into the mouth of the player character.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Like, that's all you can do with Bird, right? He just says a bunch of nonsense, and you can, of course, threaten to kill him and otherwise just, like, I don't know, ramble with him. You don't learn a whole lot more other than he has a similar kind of, like, God bless America kind of outlook, which again tells you, I think, far more about the Enclave and who they are, a type of information that we've been denied up until this point, right? Until we got here, they might as well have just been, like, dudes with really cool power armor. So after speaking with Vice President Bird, I continue onward, and I meet the President of the United States.
Yeah, Richardson?
Yes, it's like President Richardson.
Yeah. He's a real lore-filled character.
He is.
Honestly, weirdly enough, I'm like looking here. This is the big thing that came from the conversation for me, and you can tell me if you got any other big stuff. But a lot of what he says is just a repetition of what Curling told you, presumably in case you didn't talk to Curling.
Mm-hmm.
But the big thing for me that happened here, which is pretty fascinating, is that he explains the thing that like the rest of Fallout 3, New Vegas, all the rest of the games that have come out since really have doubled down on, which is that the vaults are not just vaults, they are experiments.
Yes.
And like, this is probably this is the kernel of a huge amount of content to come after it. And it's actually the kernel for how Fallout 3, as we're going to see when we get to the next game, how it kind of turns from American governmental politics that we see here, how it turns into a satire. And I think it actually is often satirical of corporate stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, you've pointed this out a couple of episodes ago. Vault tech really hasn't showed up at all. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Fallout 3, when we get there, Vault Tech is everywhere. We're going to hear about Vault Tech a million times between, you know, over the rest of the show that we're doing. But yeah, so he explains that every vault had some sort of experimental process to it. So I think he mentions some had all men in them. Some opened like 60 days afterward.
Mm-hmm. Vault 13 was never supposed to open.
Yeah.
Right.
It was like it was the control group.
Because it turns out, this is massive, right? It's not just that the vaults themselves were a big social experiment carried out by Vault Tech. It was a massive social experiment carried out by Vault Tech on behalf of the United States government. And the United States government's plan the entire time was to get the people who mattered into a safe location, have these vaults kind of, you know, in their various places so other useful people could be preserved, but or also like people could be produced for other types of purposes that might be useful. And then at some point, you know, however many centuries after the nuclear dust had settled, for the Enclave to come back out and reclaim America. Like, mm-hmm. that has been, like, that was the United States plan from the get-go. And what this does is it totally recontextualizes everything that you have done over the past two games. It's wild. Because, so, one thing that I had talked about a couple of episodes ago, I mentioned the third act unfolding in this game, where you get the Gek and you get back to Arroyo, and it's just like, oh, the Enclave showed up and took everyone, and how that feels really underwhelming compared to what happened in Fallout 1, where you get the water chip, you go back to the vault, and then it turns out, like, well, you know, that was your quest at first. It was this quest for survival, but now something more is happening, right? The world has unfolded in such a way that you need to go out and track down what's happening with these mutants. Fallout 2 doesn't unfold until right now, because everything you have done so far in this game becomes like something you can reread through the knowledge of what was really going on in the Fallout continuity, right? Like, this is where, and I said this to you, via Discord when I was playing this, this is when Fallout becomes Fallout.
Yeah.
Like, right here at the end of Fallout 2, all of these planks get laid that, you know, recontextualize what you've done and also give you a way of looking at this setting kind of cohesively. And that was a perspective that we simply didn't have before, that didn't exist, right? Fallout was a world where things just kind of were, right? You just kind of lived in the aftermath of stuff. And now suddenly there is this master plot that binds it all into a self-sustaining continuity.
Yeah, that there is a, because both games up until this point, basically other than the Brotherhood of Steel and like some technology leftovers and things like that, they would have you think that there is no continuity other than those things between the previous world and the world we live in. But in fact, there has been a shadowy ideology that has pervaded everything that we've seen. You know, Vault 15, Fallout 15 coming out in 2031. But Vault 13 or Vault 15 being abandoned in Fallout 1 is not just like, oh, well, you know, it's abandoned. They had to leave, blah, blah, blah. Shady Sands has to come into being because of the plan from before the war. Like, they are a test case for, like, what is going to happen when you have to leave the vault and establish a community and get attacked by raiders. So, yeah, there's a kind of, like, weird, like, political necessity to everything that happens after the fact.
Yeah, no, and it's, like, not only this, right? This is the big thing. But the president also, like, drops a couple of more details. Specifically, right, he alleges that China was the first, they were the first people to use nukes. He calls them the goddamn Reds, I think. And then you can say, hey, you know, why did you kidnap all the Arroyo villagers? And it turns out the Arroyo villagers were kidnapped because they were descendants of Vault 13, of the people of Vault 13, which is weird because, like, wasn't it just the Vault Dweller? How did everyone become a descendant? Best not to ask that question.
Yep. keep thinking about it.
Anyway... So the
beyond that, we do know, right, that some people left with the Vault Dweller.
Oh, that is true.
I think we find that out at some point. So okay. I think, you know, it's more than just the Vault Dweller.
But anyway, right, the Arroyo was, so Vault 13 was never supposed to open. These were people who were supposed to basically be recruited by the Enclave as part of the reclamation project, right? Like, that is kind of what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to provide a control group for measuring, like, DNA variants between people who left the vaults and people who didn't. Arroyo, because people there were descended from Fault 13 folks, were also kidnapped basically to see if the FEV affected them similarly or differently to, like, whoever else, right? This again, like, the fundamental division that the Enclave is trying to make between different types of humans here does not hold, does not make any sense, so I'm not going to dwell on it too much. But this also explains, like, what was going on with all those people in Vault uniforms hanging out here. It turns out, when the Enclave came in and cleared out Vault 13, there were people who were like, hell yeah, let's do it. And then there were also people who didn't want to do it, and those were the folks you saw in the cells across from the Arroyo tribe's people. So, mm-hmm. again, like, we get suddenly a, like, a... It's not quite like environmental storytelling, right? But you see things throughout this map, and suddenly they gain this new context where it's like, oh crap! Like, the people in the vault, like, were in on this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which kind of like demonstrates, or well, there's some weird stuff going on with that too, which is like, if that is the case, and there are, like, multiple factions and different ways of doing this, then, like, what's up with the Overseer stuff and, like, you know, overthrowing the Overseer? But the other thing, I guess, that's interesting there is that, you know, or brings a question to mind is, did the Overseer know that at the end of Fallout 1? And so that's why the Vault Dweller couldn't come back, is because if you do that, then that messes up the control group thing.
Right. And this is what I mean when I say, like, This is where Fallout becomes Fallout, because what do you do after you finish this game? You go back and you replay Fallout 1 and you replay Fallout 2, keeping all of this in mind, and you develop a new narrative about what these games mean.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, this is, like, if you can tell, like, from the tone of my voice, there's something a little ingenious about the way this works, because really all it is a retcon.
Yeah.
Right. It's just straight up like your normal retcon, but it is a retcon that does this great improvisational trick, which is to say that it hooks together so many things that have come before and makes you look at them in a new way that everything suddenly feels more effused with meaning than it was.
Yeah, it's very Star Trek retcon.
Yeah.
Like when they like reveal pieces of the world in Star Trek, and I'm not like a Star Trek fan, but you know, I've read about these kinds of things where it's like, oh, in fact, because like what Star Trek Discovery is kind of a big chunk of that, of like, oh, all the things you thought you knew, it's true because blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Star Wars does this too, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. Mm-hmm. I thought it was good.
The other thing that, of course, the president says is that he says, once again, America will be the world's policeman.
Yeah, he does. He has a lot of that kind of thing. I might have written one down. Oh, yeah, he says that people who are mutated are guilty of mutation.
Yes.
Which I thought was I think that's a pretty clever, you know, way of working the ideology of what these people believe into the way that they talk about the people.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't really give me any more information about how to accomplish my goal. And that's basically, I mean, what you just told me is actually more than I got out of that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think I had, you know, access to all of it. But after that, we had to go down one more floor.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that actually happened with me is Helenor killed him.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like, it was interesting because I pursued this conversation in such a way that I got to a point where, like, the only thing I could do was basically threaten to kill him.
Okay.
Like, that was just, like, that was how this conversation was going to have to end. You know, doing a lot of the normal villain hero stuff where I'm like, oh, this will never work, you're not thinking this through, blah, 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 blah. And one of his final lines, actually, is something like, no, you don't understand, like, the near humans on the mainland, they will gladly sacrifice themselves in order to ensure the future of true humanity, which is another like bit of interesting ideological breadcrumbing there, right? That idea that like no, there are people on our side on the mainland who will gladly just like all let themselves get obliterated in order for mm-hmm. us to succeed. And then I was like, well, I guess I'm going to kill you, and the conversation ends. And he doesn't combat me, right? He doesn't, like, aggro me or anything. But, I don't know, Helenor made a promise, and he didn't seem like a great guy, so I pulled out my gun and shot him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went downstairs.
So did it, like, alert everybody?
Everyone was dead, Cameron.
But I thought you said power armor people didn't die.
Did oh, yeah, care? Yeah, no, they alerted, but, like, they were all very far away.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, because they're mostly, like, in, like, these little, like, break room-looking things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you go downstairs, and without getting into this, because I do not want to talk about this, but you go downstairs, and there's a puzzle.
Oh, God.
And it's not interesting.
No, it's bad.
Can we just say that? It's just not interesting.
Yep.
It's a puzzle that's like a door opening puzzle. Apparently, it has two side rooms that have guards in them. Apparently, one of those side rooms has a Gek in it, mm-hmm. if you haven't already gotten a Gek. Because that's another thing the Elder tells you, is if you don't have a Gek currently, you can find one here. And then you solve that puzzle, and then you go down one more floor.
Yep. Yep, yep, yep. So you go through the nine-room door opening puzzle, go downstairs... Yep. And now you are on the level that has the generator on it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is slightly confusing because you would think you would be... Well, I guess Helinor has a high enough like science skill to use computers, but not high enough to actually do much with them. So there are all these computer terminals around that I assume like, oh, I'm probably going to be able to like hack one of these or like do something with it that will let me overload the generator or whatever. But no, all of them are just screaming at me about how there's poison in the air now.
Got it. Well, that's a weird thing here. Okay, so I, you know, got a good science skill. I'm running around. I'm trying to use all these computer terminals. They don't do anything. And I know I'm supposed to be blowing this thing up, right? Like, I know that.
Mm-hmm.
This is compounded. My confusion is compounded by right outside the lab of Curling, right outside Curling's bedroom, there's a thing that is labeled bomb that has a hand icon. But you can't do anything with it. And so I got really confused. I was like, am I supposed to go up there and do something with it? Am I supposed to be doing something down here? Because I can't interact with this generator. So I ended up having to look it up because I didn't want to, like, you know, just trial and error my way through it. And basically, the way I did it, and you tell me how you did it, but I just, so I looked it up. And you can just use a, you know, set a time bomb, drop it beside the computers that control the generator and run away. It'll explode. And that's what I did. I had some dynamite. I dropped it.
Yep. That is precisely what I did. Right down to being like, what on earth am I supposed to be doing? How is this supposed to work? Let's pause the game and check a walkthrough. Oh, I guess you can't, like, it turns out, I guess you can hack those terminals, but in my case, I think having released the poison, like, overrides that option or something. So, yeah, but I ended up doing the same thing. I had some dynamite on me, and I dropped it by the generator and blew it up.
I mean, maybe I wasn't using the right terminal or something, but I kept getting these, like, it actually kind of ended up making me very frustrated, because I just kept getting these snarky things of, like, you're playing on the computer is a game called Fallout 2. It's fully 3D with blah blah blah, and it's like all these like references to other games that existed at the time. And I was just so in my head, I was like, oh my god, if you don't let me just get beyond this like snarky shit and let me play the game, maybe so. But anyway, so I did that. There is a spiral staircase in the south of all these maps, and it's like an emergency exit. So I went and used that and zipped all the way back up to the top. And ran out of the base. But before I could run out of the base, Michael, do you know who was there?
Who was there?
The big guy that we keep seeing everywhere.
The big guy! The big guy was there.
His name is Frank Horrigan.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Horrigan used to be, this is something the president told me too, or implied. No, maybe Curling, one of those two.
Curling told me this.
Yeah, okay, so Curling says, because I, you know, you can say, hey, oh, FEV... Didn't the master use that to make super mutants? And he's like, well, we tried to use it on one of our Secret Service agents, and there was some like bad side effects. You know, it didn't really work right. Every time we have seen over the course of the game, right, because we both got that cutscene in the desert. I think I've seen this big guy one more time over the course of the game. I can't place it. But he is, in fact, like a super mutant in Enclave armor, mm-hmm. basically, who still, you know, is... has like all of his faculties.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so basically a guy stopped me. Is like, hey, watch out. Frank Horrigan's out there and he's murdering literally everybody on the way. And I was like, well, this base is about to blow up, so you might want to help me fight my way out of here. And he was like, nah, that's fake. I don't believe that. And I was like, all right, buddy. And I'm pretty sure, I can't remember the exact line, I didn't write it down, but I said something to him. The closing line is really good. It's like, well, I hope that armor floats. It's like something very close to that. And so I ran out there and initiated combat. Frank Corrigan is there, and I stabbed him a billion times.
Yes.
Like 1 billion times. He's got so many hit points. And then I left. He has like a really... like awful death animation though.
Yeah, so I convinced those guys, they're enclave soldiers who stop you and are like, hey, just so you know, like, our boss is murdering everyone. So I convinced those guys to help me. I was like, you know, like, what would you rather, you know, perish like a dog or whatever. But so they helped me, and yeah, I just to recap, right, I have hacked this game, I have hacked my character. Helenor is doing incredible amounts of damage. It's like she's rolling critical hits with every single shot. I have to shoot Frank Corrigan like 10 times. And also that's with like at one point in the middle of there, I was like, I wonder if me hacking my character has messed this up, because he staggered. And I was like, maybe he, you know, has some like final villain thing that I have somehow overridden by hacking this game. So I ended my turn and let all of my buddies have their rounds like firing in on him. And he still didn't die. You're right, he explodes, and, like, he explodes in half. Like, the front half of him is, like, crawling around on the ground, separated from the back.
Yeah, yeah, he, like, explodes, yeah, like, at the waist. He's doing, like, a, I don't even know, like, a 1990s cartoon-looking ass thing, where he's, like, you know, like... it's like a chimpanzee, kind of, right? Like a cartoon chimpanzee, where you're, like, walking around on your arms, and you have, like, smaller feet. Really weird stuff. And then I ran out. You know, it's not like there's a big thing. It's just, he's there to be a final boss, and you have a final boss fight.
Yeah. And he like insults you and stuff. It's interesting how, I mean, he's basically Darth Vader, right? Formally speaking, yeah. Right? That is what he is. But also he does not feel that integrated into the game, even after all of this Enclave stuff.
No. No, I mean, he's just there to be like a Darth Vader, right? Like a recognizable face of the Enclave. I'm curious about whether he was in the plot to begin with, or if he was an addition later. Because he's not really in any crucial scenes, although no one from the Enclave is in any crucial scenes. So kind of hard to know.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you feel about the final cutscene?
We get to watch the oil rig explode, because all the other thing we find out is that Horrigan has tripped the self-destruct for it. So you have from the moment that you destroy the generator, you have like 9 minutes in game to escape. So you leave, everyone gets on the boat and they sail away, and then you get to watch the oil rig explode, and I have to say, it's not as cool as watching the cathedral explode in the first game.
It's not. It's a much more traditional kind of, you know, atomic bomb explosion deal.
Yeah.
But then we find out about, you know, it's the part everyone loves. What happened at the end?
Yeah. All the things that happened at the end.
Okay, you want me? I'll start reading. You can tell me where you diverge, okay?
Okay.
Okay, first one I got, MODOK.
Oh, interesting.
MODOK and the Slags, doing great. They've got ample food, and they trade with other people in the wasteland.
Yep.
Okay. Slavery is gone from the den, and Becky from Becky's Bar is like, now good. You know, she's like a power player in the region, and the den is like a nice place full of respectable folks.
Yes, it becomes like a... it's like a tough but honest community or something, as Perlman tells us.
Yep. Ron Perlman, of course, is telling us all this stuff. Just off the dome. He just knows it. Vault City suffers more raider attacks and eventually ends up allied with the NCR. And then the NCR eventually puts basically an occupying army in Vault City.
Yep.
Making it kind of, you know, an occupied territory.
Mm-hmm.
New Reno, the Wright family, takes over. The city becomes, you know, like a place people want to come and immigrate to, not just a place where they want to visit. And this is really weird. The test scores eventually become higher than the test scores that people had before the bombs dropped.
What?
Did you not get this?
No. What the hell does that mean?
It explicitly says, hold on. I'll read the exact line to you. Test scores. Fallout 2, let's see, endings. Fallout 2 endings. I'm reading from the Fallout fandom wiki, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Oh god, there's so many. Okay. So I got ending 10. The rites transform New Reno into a civilized city. That's the name of the thing here.
Okay.
Within a year of the Enclave's destruction, the Wright family turned from criminal activity to legitimate pursuits. Several schools and churches were established in New Reno, along with a law enforcement body that crippled the influence of the families. Though New Reno lost most of its edge, the city obtained a certain solidity that appealed to newcomers. Many came to Reno, not to visit, but to live, and the population increased threefold. Today, the test scores of New Reno high school graduates are greater than many Californian schools before the war.
What a bizarre ending.
Isn't that weird? Isn't that just like a really weird thing to write there? So I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. And then go ahead.
I was going to say, do you want to hear my version of New Reno?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So in my game, the bishops gained power.
Okay.
Because they were already working through, you know, backhand dealings with the NCR, because mm-hmm. the bishops ascended, the NCR slowly gained more and more influence in New Reno. The narration specifically calls these like cynical backroom dealings. So mm-hmm. There's, you know, this slight, I guess, critique, or actually I would say it is cynical, right? There's a cynicism here for the game about these political maneuverings, that the bishops take over NCR, or take over New Reno, eventually of course lead it into NCR. NCR, you know, takes it over, and the bishops of course are always there to ensure that gambling rights and prostitution rights are protected in NCR law.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So still kind of a good ending in the sense of like people aren't being murdered in the street.
Yes. Yes.
Here's a weird one that I've never heard of. Can I read you a weird one?
Okay.
If you impregnate either the bishop daughter or the bishop wife, Leslie or Angela, you get this ending. Not long after the destruction of the Enclave, the bishop family of New Reno was blessed with a child. The child seemed to have little in common with the bishops, preferring instead to spend his days exploring the wastes. When he turned 13, he seized control of the bishop family and led them to victory over the remaining New Reno families. He died quietly in his sleep at the age of 73, never having known his real father.
Okay.
That's a weird one, isn't it?
It's weird and also interesting for how it preserves the conceit of these games that being a player character is genetically inherited.
Yeah, basically.
Like that is. Sort of seems to be what's happening there.
Yeah, being a person of action.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course we got the Myron ending, right? We both got the Myron ending, which is I'll just read it too. Myron died less than a year after the defeat of the Enclave, stabbed by a Jet addict while drinking in the den. His discovery of Jet was quickly forgotten, and now there is no one who remembers his name.
This is so weird because a lot of my party members did die, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I know, this is the only party member that gets a specific shout out in the ending.
Yeah.
And it does not change. It's like he is shouted out specifically to be like, you remember this guy? He died. He got murdered.
Yeah.
No one cared. He sucked.
They didn't care for him. Mm-hmm. The developers, I guess. So I got those. I got Gecko next.
Mm-hmm.
Gecko has a power surplus, but because we didn't like, or I didn't, whatever, massage that relationship well enough with the Vault City, Vault City just eventually invaded them and then turned all the ghouls into slaves.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a bummer. It's no good.
Yep, it's a bummer. It's no good. Also confusing, because I have already established that Vault City has been taken over by the NCR, which doesn't allow slavery.
Well, Vault City, or NCR, doesn't allow it within the city gates, right? So, you know, this could be one of those little scenarios.
Yeah.
Redding just disappears.
Oh. For me, Marge LaBarge, who I gave the chip to, I remember, I specifically went back to Redding to tie this loose end up. Marge LaBarge took over Redding because she had her own mine, and then she took out the Cocoa Weef, which I guess eventually, like, all of the aliens in there died. And then she also turned Redding into an outpost of the NCR.
I got deserted, literally. Nothing now exists but the desiccated husk of what once was Redding. Broken Hills dispersed because the uranium ran out. Same thing you got. Vault 13, I got blamed for it. It was like, because you killed all of the Death Claws. Bad stuff happened. You know, the Death Claws are dead now. Good work. So I don't know what happened there. Was not my fault.
So wait, what did happen to Vault 13? Like, what happens because all the Death Claws are dead?
That's it. That's just what it says. Oh, so here's the quote. By eliminating the Death Claws of Vault 13, you banished yet another species to the realms of extinction, proving once again that genocide is a viable solution to any problem.
Okay.
So it's trying to be a little bit funny, too.
Yeah. Nothing funnier than genocide. I didn't even get an ending for Vault 13, so okay.
Oh, interesting. It's apparently, so there used to be a positive ending to the game, or there is a positive ending in the game, but there is a scripting error that makes it never trigger. So you either get no ending or you get the negative ending.
Oh, what's the, does it have like, do you have a transcript of the positive ending up or?
Yep. So a requirement for this is prevent the massacre by killing Dr. Schraber and fix the vault computer.
Oh, interesting.
So you can do, I did both of those things, but with your aid, the Death Claws of Vault 13 became a thriving community. When the vault could no longer hold their numbers, a peaceful campaign of expansion was launched to claim the surrounding lands.
All right.
So they're good. They're like the only unalloyed good faction.
I was thinking about that the other day, actually, how, like, of all of the factions in this game, literally the only, like, good faction is the Talking Death Claws.
Yeah.
They're the faction that is explicitly most concerned with, like, helping people.
Yeah, they're good. They're just good people. So, you know, I don't know. We saved their lives, at least, if they weren't already dead. The NCR expanded more slowly. Because I didn't do anything with Vault 15, President Tandy gets replaced by Roger Weston. And then they went to try to figure out what was going on at Vault 15, and everyone was gone there. Yeah.
I had the NCR for me just, you know, expanded in its push to, quote unquote, civilize its neighbors. Vault 15 came right into the fold, and NCR is, you know, hunky-dory, basically.
Okay. Vault 15, it's deserted. Everyone's gone. Because it gets its own little thing. But I'm assuming you got the opposite, which is that it's hunky-dory.
Yep.
The San Francisco one was really weird. Okay, so this is the thing. I got the She Flourish. The She Flourished, creating a botanical scourge on the radiation surrounding their beloved town. Though this vine could not grow in other soils, the She took care to nourish it in their lands. They continue to grow in strength and prominence, forming the basis of a new empire.
I also got that.
What's that mean?
So
was there a botanical metaphor that I just didn't find out about?
So when you can look at the She's computer, you can find out that they're doing all sorts of like biological and chemical experiments. I don't remember them specifically researching a type of vine, but I guess that's something that I'm supposed to take from this, because you see, like, in the ending here, you see, like, this ending shot of Chinatown, and it's covered in, like, this, I mean, It looks like a vine that is also like sakura blossoms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it does have that because it's like at nighttime.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, it just, I don't know what to make of it, right? Because it doesn't make any sense. Like, there, I didn't really encounter the Shi talking about, like, you know what we really need to do is genetically engineer a new type of vine. And I also don't understand how them having made this new kind of vegetation necessarily, like, helps them consolidate power.
Yeah, so, I mean, so here's the other one, right? Sentient, here's another ending. It's called Sentient Plant Problems here on this wiki. The strain of plant the scientists were growing mutated, gaining a measure of sentience. It killed the laboratory technicians and took over the laboratory in which it was first conceived. It took a massive concentration of resources to crush it, and this left the Shi poverty stricken. They disappeared into the wastes. Like, I just have no information about any of that. Tanker vagrants. The people who lived outside the tanker, they moved on.
Yep.
Did you get any other endings?
Did you not get an Arroyo ending?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Okay,
yeah,
I was going to say, that was my first one, but you went straight into MODOK.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't write it down. A-OK, it was good.
Yeah, no, same for me. Like, Arroyo and the people rescued from Vault 13 hooked up, and they used the GEC to make a new community, and you get this bizarre screenshot of, I guess, what this community looks like that they made with the GEC, and it has, like, two capital buildings.
Yeah, it's like a, like, almost like a Moroccan architecture, like domes, and it's like the roofs of buildings are like almost Italian looking, but then it's like these Moroccan looking domes everywhere. Yeah. Very Capitol building esque. I have no idea if that's like a picture from somewhere that they just photoshopped or what. But
and that's how the game ends.
You didn't get any other ones?
That was it. Those were all the endings I had.
That's interesting. So this wiki says that there are a couple other ones that I didn't get any. There's an Enclave ending that I didn't see.
I assume the Enclave has to survive for that ending to happen.
Oh, maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. But can you finish it without blowing up the thing?
I don't know.
I don't know. Let us know, people who played the games. And there's a Hubologist ending. Did you get a Hubologist ending?
I did not, because I exterminated the Hubologists.
Okay, well, you already knew the ending for it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool. I mean, I think we've already talked about kind of our feelings about the ending here. Yeah. You know, I thought it was good. I think it's a good, kind of end of the thing. I am a lot more... I wish that the things that showed up in this end of the game, in the last hour of the game, I wish they showed up across the rest of the game. I think it really would have improved the experience. I think there's a lot of game design ethic here at the end of the game that gets picked up in Fallout 3. Mm-hmm. And I wish that we're more present in Fallout 2.
You know, it was wild to me playing the end of this game and, like, suddenly understanding, like, oh, this is why people, like, got so hot on this series, because it ends in such an incredible way where everything, like, the entire franchise up to that point gets recontextualized, and then suddenly you think the next game is going to explore the implications of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And instead we have what, you know, I've already said, which is that we have a decade of people just replaying these two games with kind of this retcon in mind and building up this narrative, like, taking the political teeth that Fallout 2 grows at the very end, and then reading it back into the beginning of the game and noticing, like, oh, you know, isn't it weird how there are all these, like, really, like, peppy 50s style advertisements plastered all over these ruins. Well, we know from the end of Fallout 2 this is what the world was like, and so we can now understand these as, you know, satirical, quote unquote. It was really wild playing the end of this game, and I think kind of suddenly starting to understand why people were really so hot on this game in particular and sort of Fallout as a franchise, because of where it leaves you with this feeling like, oh, the next game, Fallout 3, is going to look at the implications of all of these things that we just learned. And sort of strangely enough, like, in 2020 playing this game, playing the very end feels like you are watching the franchise of Fallout assemble itself. Like, you see all of these things lock into place. Like, oh, the vaults and all of the wacky social experiments and all of the, like, the 50s retrofuturism because of what the Enclave has given us can now be reread as parodic or ironic or satirical or something like that. It's a very fascinating thing to see happen, and it almost boggles the mind that, like, for a good long while, this is where the franchise ends, right? This is where people get left hanging. And I think in many ways it explains the relationship to Fallout we have all collectively developed up to now.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an appropriate end. So the next episode that we're going to record of this, or that will be released of this, will be, we're going to read the Fallout Bible. If you don't know what that is, we'll explain that in the episode.
It's the Bible, but all of the names have been replaced with Fallout characters.
It's Metzger the other Fallout names.
Cameron.
Kevin. You know, all those names.
Marge LaBarge.
Exactly. You know, the classics. Then there will be a little bit of a release break between seasons 2 and 3, and then we will come on back for Fallout 3. Michael's bought a new PC for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's got spinning whirligigs on it.
Oh, the sacrifices I make for you people.
Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, you know, you can go to patreon.com/strangetouch in order to support the show, materials costs, things like that. It's all very helpful. You can go to twitter.com/rangetouch in order to find out more about this. If you're watching this on YouTube and you have not subscribed, hit that subscription button. If you haven't liked this video, please hit the like button. It's so easy to do. Helps more people see it. And if you like this series, please tell more people about it. That would really help us out. We don't do any advertising, so word of mouth is a big deal. Michael, where can they find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter @WarrenIsDead.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with the Fallout Bible.
Until next time, war never changes, but Fallout sure does. Everything changed when the bombs fell, except for